Organizers. My goal for the talk today is to give you a perspective of how evolutionary biology can contribute to making well-informed conservation and management decisions. I want to set the expectation that I'm giving a food for thought kind of talk, and so this will be primarily conceptual, although I will illustrate it with some concrete examples. So I wanted to start in somewhat of an unusual way and give you a deep evolutionary time perspective on the history of biological diversity on our planet. So life on our planet began more than 3.5 billion years ago. And you can represent the history of life on Earth as a branching tree. So for those of you that aren't familiar with looking at evolutionary trees, this is just like a family genealogy. So we're looking at the beginning of life and the branching process by which a single lineage branches into multiple lineages up until the present day. And so in the present day, you can identify species that are more closely related to each other and species that are more distantly related to each other. Just like in a family tree, you can look at brothers and sisters versus distant cousins. So the point here is that from a single common ancestor, we now have a phenomenal amount of biological diversity on our planet. Our current best estimate of how many species are inhabiting planet Earth is more than 8.5 million. And what this means is that we've had billions of years of diversification on our planet, but this is balanced by billions of years of extinction. So this is just a schematic, this isn't the true tree of life, but the point I want to make here is that from this rich history of speciation, many of those lineages have gone extinct. So the species that we have today are a small representative of the evolutionary history on our planet. The reason why this is important is that more than 99% of all species that ever existed have gone extinct. So extinction is a normal process on our planet. We have a dynamic history where lineages speciate, flourish, and go away. Now, we're not here to talk about what's happened over the last 3 billion years. We're here to talk about what's happening today. And the reason I start with this context is to make sure that we understand there's a dynamic history of speciation and extinction on our planet, but to understand that what's happening today is not the same as what has happened in the past. So why is what's happening today in terms of extinction different than what's happened over the last 3.5 billion years of the Earth's history? Well, it's different because of us, and I certainly don't need to make a big fuss about this for this audience. Human impacts on our planet have been extreme not only over the last hundreds of years, but also over the last many thousands of years, sufficient to the point that some people are talking about coining a new geological epoch to describe our impact on the planet, which would be called the Anthropocene. So over the Earth's long history, there have been 5 natural mass extinction events that are recognized by scientists where biodiversity has really crashed on our planet. And we are currently in the middle of what is being referred to as the 6th mass extinction event. And this mass extinction event is different from previous mass extinction events because it's being mediated by human activities on the planet. So we are in a time-critical and somewhat awkward position where we are causing mass extinctions, and we are also charged with trying to ameliorate that problem. And so what I want to talk about today is a conservation conundrum, which is that we can't, given that conservation efforts are costly and time-intensive, we can't save all 8.5 million species on the planet. We have to make some decisions, and this has been called conservation triage. And so, from the perspective of our topic today, the question of what populations we need to save is nested in a bigger question of what species we need to save. And so what I would like to do is talk about both of those things, what species should we save, and also what populations within those species will we choose to spend our conservation dollar on. So what I'd like to do is just motivate that conundrum for you with a brief introduction from my own research, and then just tell you about a few examples of how evolutionary biologists are trying to contribute with creative ideas for how to help guide conservation decision making. So here's an example. I work on amphibians, and as many of you know, more than a third of amphibians are currently highly threatened with extinction. And so we start with a higher level question before we get to populations, which is which species do we want to save? There is a phenomenal amount of diversity in amphibians. Many amphibians play key roles in ecosystems. Some of them have medicinal value for humans, and most, if not all, have aesthetic or existence value. And so who wants to be the one to decide whether we want to prioritize these awesome gastric brooding frogs that actually brood their babies in their gastric cavities, or Sicilians, which are amphibians that some of you have probably never even heard exist. And so there's a phenomenal amount of biodiversity that we're going to have to make hard decisions about. But say that we decide to save one of my favorite species and one of Ron's favorite species. Here's the mountain yellow-legged frog. So say we've made a first-pass conservation decision and I win. I get to keep working on my species. Well, the mountain yellow-legged frog is found here in California, the Sierra Nevada Mountains. It's being threatened by a whole bunch of different anthropogenic activities, but it's also being threatened by an emerging and invasive fungal pathogen, the chytrid fungus. And so the point I want to make here is that even if we've decided we care about this species, we now have a nested question, which is, well, we have diversity even within this species. So here is just a quick graph to show you how we have differences within species. So in some of our populations of mountain yellow-legged frogs, when this fungus arrives, the populations are really decimated, where in other populations, the populations decline but then recover. So now we have a population question inside the species question, which is, well, should we spend our conservation dollar on these populations because, boy, they really need our help? Or should we spend our conservation dollar on these species because they might actually have a chance of surviving these epidemics? And then, not to belabor the point, but finally, even once we've decided, okay, let's preserve the more resistant species and put our conservation efforts there, this is just a map showing you the historical locations of mountain yellow-legged frog populations. The ones in yellow are still extant today. And even though these populations are all teeny, there's lots of them. And all of our methods for ameliorating disease impacts are extremely labor intensive, and so we can only choose a small subset of populations within our species that we're going to conserve. Okay, so how can we use evolutionary ideas to think about conservation priority setting? And I would just like to give you two anecdotal examples, one at the species level and one at the population level. Obviously, there's a lot of work in this area, but I picked two creative solutions that colleagues have proposed for using evolutionary methods for making conservation planning decisions. The first is an example at the species level. This is a creative project coming out of the Zoological Society of London. Has anyone heard of this EDGE project before, other than the people that here we have an interesting proposal, which is that we should use evolutionary trees, those branching structures called phylogenies, to give species a ranking on how evolutionarily unique they are, so an evolutionary isolation ranking, and then we should weight these scores based on how endangered the animals are. And so this is a schematic to give you a sense of how this works. Say we have three areas, X, Y, and Z, that we can decide to spend our conservation dollar on. And we decide at a first pass we're going to put our efforts on area X because we'll preserve the most numbers of species. Well, now we have a little money left over. We're deciding whether to spend it on area Y or Z. Well, if we just want to preserve, maximize the number of species to protect, we should protect area Y. But if we want to maximize the evolutionary diversity in what we're protecting, we should instead protect area Z. So let me give you a real-world example here. This is a lemur evolutionary tree. You don't have to worry about the names or the details. What I want you to see is these red arrows, which are the species that I've highlighted that are listed as critically endangered based on the IUCN Red List rankings. And so a more traditional conservation approach might be to say, well, these species are the most highly endangered. These are the ones that we should spend our effort towards protecting. But if we use this EDGE approach, we get a very different answer. So now you see the tree has these highlighted red lines, and these indicate the species that would be listed as highest priority if we were using this EDGE method. If we were taking the IUCN Red List rankings, but we were filtering them through a priority of prioritizing evolutionary diversity, not just species that are declining the most quickly. And so my point here is to show that different conservation priorities lead to very different outcomes. It's really different if we decide to prioritize the species with the red branches or the species with the orange arrows. We're going to end up with a very different set of lemurs left going into the next century. So the edge strategy actually seems to work very well. There's been a lot of papers in many different systems suggesting that if we maximize phylogenetic diversity, we also catch a lot of other traits that we care about. So if we try to save a diverse number of things, then a byproduct of that is we end up with diverse ecologies, diverse life histories, diverse organisms that serve different ecosystem functions, and also that have economical importance for human use. So this is just one example from the Finbos region in South Africa. But there are some limitations to the edge approach as well. Before I say that, so the other thing that the edge approach does really well is that the edge approach helps us save some of the really charismatic and odd species on Earth that we would want to save, right? I want the tuatara to stay around. And so many of you probably also have kind of favorite ancient lineages that it would just be a shame to lose from our planet. But what the edge approach doesn't do as well is prioritize recent evolutionary divergence. And the reason why I think this is critically important is that we have a lot of species that have adapted and evolved very quickly to contemporary conditions, where rapid evolution has meant that they are special and unique in ecological ways, but not yet special and unique from a deep evolutionary perspective. And some of these species might actually be the best bet as far as thinking about how to preserve evolutionary potential when we look towards the future where environments will be changing very rapidly. Okay, so let's look at a second example. I want to zoom in now to the population level. So the edge approach is one evolutionary proposal for how to make conservation decisions at the species level. We're looking at big phylogenetic trees and deciding which species are going to be our highest priority. But that doesn't help us as much when we start zooming in and thinking about individual populations, particularly very small populations. So here I want to highlight one approach, which it was developed to help address this challenge, which is a challenge to identify what the units of conservation should be. Right? So say we bought into an edge approach and we picked our 10 lemurs that we want to save. Well, when we go out into the field, you can't just say calling all lemurs of species X, right? We need to identify specific areas and populations that we are going to be able to give more intensive management efforts towards. And so in walks this very controversial and long debated idea of defining evolutionarily significant units, or ESUs. So there have been a lot of different definitions in the literature, and I won't belabor the debate about this, except to give you the idea that there's a spectrum of ways to define ESUs, but that many of them have to do with defining populations or groups of populations that are distinct genetically or distinct reproductively in some way. And so here's one example of the robust red horse, and some people in the audience might know more about this fish than I do, but this is a case study where the ESU approach worked extremely well. So this species was described in the late 1800s and then was lost to science for more than 100 years. It was rediscovered in the 90s, but with extremely small and very fragile populations. And this is a case where we can define ESUs very, very easily. So for those of you that aren't geneticists, don't worry about what I mean by genetic type. What I want you to notice here is that there are two main river watersheds here that have two separate populations. And these populations are just genetically quite distinct. So all of the fish in this river are genetic type A or B, whereas all the fish in this river are genetic type C, D, or E. What that means is that based on simple ESU criteria, we can say, well, we should divide this species into two different units for management. And so that makes our conservation implementation a lot easier because we've defined our biological units at a scale that's compatible with our management implementation, right? So we're not just saying, let's save lemurs. We're saying, let's have a specific approach for the management of a particular very small population at a geographic scale that we can work with. And why this is important to define ESUs is because that would affect your management choices. For example, whether you thought it was appropriate to translocate fish from one of these rivers into the other. But sometimes ESUs are very hard to delineate, and sometimes different types of data conflict. And here's one example from my own research. These are lizards that inhabit white sands. Has anyone been to white sands in New Mexico?
No one ever goes there. It's a cool place.
So this is a geologically very recent formation. These white sand dunes are dramatic. They're as white as a piece of bleached paper. And they're very young. They're just a couple of thousand years old. And it's not just this one lizard species. There's a whole bunch of reptiles, mammals, and invertebrates that have recent adaptations to this formation. Many of them are white in color. But if we compare the light lizards and the dark lizards, they're actually different from each other in almost every way that we can imagine. And so one of the interesting things here is this is one of those examples where these two forms are ecologically entirely distinct. But because it's so recent, if we look at a genetic tree, so now the tree, instead of pointing up, is pointing to the side. This is just the tips of this tree are just lots of different individuals. And the bar is just a schematic to show you how they're related to each other. So if an animal is from the white sands, there's a white bar. And if they're from the dark habitat in the Chihuahuan Desert, there's a dark bar. And so what you can see is that they're all mixed up together genetically. They're not distinct genetically in any way. And so in traditional ESU criteria, it would be very difficult to propose to manage these unique populations differently from the rest of the species that they've diverged from. But from a conservation perspective, these guys are incredibly unique and represent a real evolutionary pump where you have all this diversification that's happening really quickly in this landscape, and it would be a shame not to treat that landscape as a separate entity. Okay, so what some people have advocated for is having a more flexible definition of ESUs. We don't want to just say you have to be 3% diverged in your mitochondrial genome or something like that. We want to be able to take lots of different traits that we might value into account when we define evolutionarily significant units. And the last point I wanted to make about the ESUs is even if we're explicit about what we're taking into account, we still need to make value judgments. So we can't just plug our ESU criteria into our supercomputer and say, tell me which populations to save, because we still need to make choices. This is just an example from the wet tropics in Australia. And what I'm showing you here is just a map where different areas are shaded different colors. We have areas like this one in black, where if we spent our conservation dollar here, we would maximize the protection of lots of species and also lots of genetic diversity. But there are lots of areas where we can't have both, right? If we choose to protect this area, we're going to get lots of genetic diversity, but not necessarily lots of species diversity. And then there's also these interesting areas that are patched that are called admixture zones, which don't really fit into either of the previous categories, but are places in the wet tropics that have very dynamic evolutionary processes occurring, where we have different lineages hybridizing, and so we need to still think clearly about what we value in order to make decisions about conservation priorities. Okay, so what I would like to end with is drawing out some different themes about how an evolutionary perspective can add value to conservation planning, particularly for small populations on the brink of extinction, where we do have to make choices. We can't just preserve and conserve everything. Okay, so theme number one, there is no one-size-fits-all solution. There's lots of different modes of speciation, so organisms have come on Earth in different ways, and there's lots of different threats that are currently impacting different species. So if organisms arise in different ways and are threatened with extinction in different ways, we can't expect that we can have one blanket strategy for deciding which of them are the most important to protect. Theme two is that it's not all doom and gloom, because even though we have to make decisions, we have lots of great tools at our disposal to make those decisions. So we're lucky to be at a day and age where genetic data is cheap and easy to access, where new algorithms are being developed and new statistical methods are being developed to help do broad-scale analyses to identify things like evolutionary uniqueness. And so we have a lot of methods available to give us quantitative ways to think about how to rank priorities based on population sizes, population connectivity, evolutionary uniqueness. One of the most important themes is that it's very important that we integrate multiple criteria for assessing our conservation priorities. So we need to value lots of different aspects effects of biodiversity, not just species numbers and not just population size. So I might want to save populations that are the most savable. Avis might want to save populations that have the most charisma, and the EDGE project leaders might want to save populations that have the most evolutionary uniqueness. And none of those approaches are better or worse than others, but we need to be explicit about what we're valuing in each individual situation. Okay, one of the really important take-home messages is that I want people to be thinking about not just the products of evolution, but the processes of evolution. So I'm not saying we shouldn't save panda bears, but panda bears and any other species of your favorite species is a product of evolution that will have a relatively short lifespan on the history of our planet. It's not to say that we shouldn't do everything in our power to save them, but we also want to think about the processes themselves that generate diversity. And so there's some interesting literature in the evolutionary conservation world about thinking about, in addition to preserving and conserving species, preserving landscapes that might have particular features that act as what we call species pumps, as ways to generate biodiversity. And so that leads into my very last slide, which is that we know a lot more about our past than we know about our future. But one of the things we do know about our future is that it won't look like today. And so one of the lessons that I think evolutionary biology can add value to conservation science is that we need to be thinking about how to protect the species that are important right now, but also how to think about the evolutionary potential for how biodiversity will rebound into tomorrow. So with that, I would like to thank all of you and thank everyone for coming this evening. So the question that was that when you have rapid evolution, sometimes you're gaining things and sometimes you're losing things as far as the characteristics of the species. As an evolutionary biologist, and maybe it would be interesting to talk more about specifically what you're thinking of. For me, I don't really think of that a new species has kind of gained something or lost something over an ancestor because they're, especially in cases of rapid evolution, they're evolving on so many different axes simultaneously that it's very hard to say, well, we've lost this but gained that, because it's such a multidimensional problem, but it's certainly something that would be interesting to talk more about.
Where in your filters comes, as you say, we can't do it all, level of effort required for any particular, mosaic or grouping, especially synergy that might occur, because if you're in one area, you might just get a whole bunch.
Yeah, absolutely. So my goal was to be a little provocative on the sense of giving some perspective from the evolutionary perspective, but not to say that all of these other practical and legal considerations don't need to be added into the equation. It is more to try to infuse this as one other thing that people might not tend to think about. But absolutely, all of our decisions have to be made in an integrated way. And so those questions about the biological diversity, the risk of extinction, the practical aspects of implementation, the political will, all of those things need to be integrated into one framework.
Yeah. Patrick, so I've been to White Sands, and I didn't see those white lizards, but anyway, but I'm a plant person, so
you drove over them.
Thank you.
Well, thank you much for Bob. So one thing I want to know, though, is that's not a plasticity response between those colors. So that is genetic variation.
Right, so
there's always this tension, not tension, but there's this trade-off between, like, molecular markers and the quantitative traits that I think
absolutely
be really.
So I glossed over that a little bit. One of the problems with ESU definitions that we're getting into deeper here is genetics is actually like 20 different things, right? Because my White Sands lizards are 100% distinguishable genetically at the single gene that causes them to be white. And I know what that gene is, so I can say they are 100% distinguishable. But that's not something that most conservation planning has in mind, because we don't know the functional variation for most of the species we care about. So we usually look at, and this came up in the last talk, is we usually look at kind of neutral genetic variation, and which, so, you know.
Yeah, so the problem is like the term neutral, what is it neutral to selection?
Right.
And so there's this old fashioned quantitative genetic stuff
right.
that is probably pretty important, and I'm
absolutely.
Not sure that functional genomics is gonna save the day, especially with non-modern organisms.
No, so I agree with that, and I would say the one thing that what I didn't want to bog down, because I think this audience, maybe some people aren't aware of that genetics can be used in conservation planning. For those people that are aware of then there's a deeper level of all sorts of discordant conflicts among different kinds of data types, and that's something that has to do with how we translate this fabulous tool into something that's implementable, and that's a hard problem.
Could you expand a little bit on your criteria for landscapes that might be species clumps?
Yeah, so.
Are you thinking about geographic units or scales?
Yeah,
or
so.
Just species richness?
So there's lots of different ways to think about that from a process perspective. One might be saying, well, there are places that are very diverse, and so maybe they have a lot of current species diversity, maybe there's something about that landscape that leads to species diversity. One thing that's been brought up a lot in the evolutionary literature is looking at areas that are called ecotones. So areas where we have rapid environmental transitions tend to be very dynamic in terms of the evolutionary processes that are occurring there. And so one of the things that we could think about on a landscape scale is not only looking at efforts towards landscapes at a big enough scale where you have population connectivity and corridors and intact habitat and not too much edge, but also thinking about have we preserved gradients in there, you know, environmental gradients, so that there's lots of options and lots of kind of ways where organisms might have ecological opportunity, or, you know, so ecotones is one example of ways to think about landscape features where you have rapid environmental change, means that often you get diversification and you have more adaptive diversity rather than longer term kind of historical isolation, but you have more contemporary processes of adaptation.
Thank you.